Thanks for listening to Pod of Jake. I'm Jake. You can reach me anytime by emailing jake@blogofjake.com. I'm fortunate to have some sponsors supporting the show whose products I genuinely love and recommend. I'll start with a word on those so the rest of the episode will have no interruptions. I hope you enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Levels. Levels uses continuous glucose monitoring to track your blood sugar in real time. It allows me to see the impact that everything I do has on my metabolic health so that I can optimize my diet and exercise accordingly. Wearing the Levels patch, I feel like I'm living in the future. There's this moment when you raise your phone to the back of your arm, it vibrates and shows your glucose level right on the screen. It's this instantaneous look inside yourself, an in-the-moment snapshot of what's going on inside your body. And while it's only showing one simple measurement for now, it's enough for me to see the future. And that's exciting. It's exciting because I believe that we can live meaningfully longer and healthier lives than we do today, and I believe technologies like Levels will help us to get there. Levels is currently running an exclusive beta program with a waitlist of over 100,000 people, but you can skip the line and join Levels today by using my link in the show notes, levels.link/Jake. Again, that's levels.link/Jake. This episode is brought to you by Aura. That's Oura. The Oura Ring, from my perspective, is the single best wearable on the market. I use it to measure my sleep, activity, and readiness on a daily basis. I bought my Oura Ring several months ago before talking with the company's CEO on the podcast. I haven't taken it off since. I believe what gets measured gets managed. So if you care at all about your health, which you should, you have to measure your sleep in order to manage it. Oura measures much more than just my time in bed. It tracks my REM sleep versus deep sleep, my resting heart rate and heart rate variability, my temperature, my activity, and much, much more. For $299, you can get your own Oura Ring on auraring.com. That's auraring.com. Auraring.com. Okay, let's get into it. Thank you, Scott, for joining me on the show today. It's a pleasure to have you. I first discovered you from your City DAO project, which you're leading. It's a DAO, so I don't know if you're necessarily like the CEO, but at the very least, it seems like you're in some fashion in charge. And you're also the co-founder of Air Garage, which I understand sort of led you in the direction of City DAO in the first place. So looking forward to touching on both of those. But first, for those who aren't familiar with you or either of these organizations, would be great to sort of get your story from as early as you're willing to start to where you are and what you're doing today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. I was listening to some previous episodes and there's some real heavy hitters on the podcast, and I'm honored to now be among their ranks. So I'll give you just a quick background. I actually started more as a musician. So I went to a music high school, played guitar and piano, and building apps kind of became this outlet for me. So I was building apps in maybe 2012 through 2015. And this was like the early days, the wild west of the app store. So, I went to Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference and, started meeting people and getting more into tech. I was from Arizona and I started realizing, wow, I should really move to the Bay Area. This is where everything is happening. So I had a couple apps that were somewhat viral. One of them was for like memorizing prefixes for your SATs, because this was, right as I was around the time of studying for your SATs. I think the app store started getting flooded with apps and my interest in that kind of faded. So I ended up going to college studying computer science. And then I would eventually drop out to build Air Garage. Air Garage started as a driveway rental app. So for example, you have an extra parking space in your driveway and you could basically rent it out. And we were helping students get matched with cheap, affordable parking near campus. But we really realized that opportunity I just described has kind of this asymptote where you have maybe a couple hundred driveways near a university or near a stadium or a downtown. And that really caps out quickly. So we started pivoting the business. And I think the big break was when we signed on a church near Arizona State University. It was this massive church with maybe 100 spaces. We signed them on. And that was really just a game changer for us because we started actually managing a legit parking operation. So that was when we started really thinking, maybe we should drop out to pursue this idea. And you know, basically with one parking lot, we kind of doubled the business, and then we realized, wow, this is where the real opportunity is. So now we run Air Garage as a we call it a full stack parking operator. So it does everything required to run a parking lot or parking garage. So you are a real estate owner, or you have a hotel or apartment or a church, we sign you on. We basically put up signage. You know, we turn you on the app, and we basically do everything it takes to run, manage, enforce your parking operation. So that was kind of the genesis of Air Garage. And kind of to dive a bit into the CityDAO project, I think, you know, through the course of building Air Garage, like we have seen, we've basically done partnerships with, you know, people who own land, and, you know, we've learned a lot about, you know, how our cities really operate. And I think, you know, one thing that immediately comes to mind is it's very inefficient, right? Like if you, Jake, were saying, I want to go buy some land, I want to go, you know, buy an apartment or parking garage or parking lot, it would be insanely difficult. You'd have a lot of conversations with brokers. You'd be researching zoning rules for long periods of time. You know, you'd be raising capital and, you know, going through these arcane legal processes with the county recorder and all this complicated stuff. So the idea with CityDAO was, what if you could just push a button to get land, right? You could just, you know, press a button, as easy as if you've used these crypto products out there, you know, for example, Uniswap or something, which allows you to just instantly convert your tokens, you know, as easy as, you know, exchanging money on Uniswap. What if you could just press a button and get land? And so that was kind of the idea behind CityDAO. I'll pause there. I know I've been talking for a while, so yeah.
Yeah, no, that was great, and it's interesting to hear how that transition sort of took place in your mind. How do you now sort of manage the, you're sort of running two projects at once, and both are fairly ambitious. How do you manage that workload and sort of division of labor, excuse me, with like a, a two focus sort of like a lot of people sort of pour all their energy into one big thing. How are you managing that workload?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I mean, right now, Air Garage is my main focus. You know, I think that the cool thing about CityDAO is it is a DAO, which for the unenlightened stands for a decentralized autonomous organization. And so the mission with CityDAO is really to decentralize it and have the people voting and governing it. And you know, I think there's a lot of community energy around this idea, and it really just it started with a tweet. I basically tweeted, I'm thinking of tokenizing a piece of land in Wyoming and selling those tokens as NFTs. Who wants in? And the tweet went kind of viral, and eventually this Discord community started building. So there's a Discord called CityDAO, and we have, you know, over 2,000 members now. And there's just a lot of people who are just doing free work and pouring their, you know, effort into the project just because they want this to exist. I think there's just a lot of energy right now at this cross section of real estate and crypto. So for example, we have, you know, basically volunteers who are just writing our smart contracts, writing our front ends, maintaining our community, researching the legal implications, and really doing that. So obviously that makes it that a lot easier when you have so much community energy and involvement. You know, my goal is to get it to a point where like people are voting which piece of land should we acquire. You know, and I think to be honest, that's like this idyllic state. At first, you know, I'm heavily involved, like sourcing, you know, what parcel, talking to brokers. But you know, the goal is to decentralize and start giving the community more and more power with that.
So why do you think, you've got all these people now sort of rallying behind this idea and working, with no sort of compensation other than maybe speculative value in the future on this idea, but people just want it to exist, like you said. What do you think it was about that initial tweet of yours, which was fairly simple, that a simple idea that really struck a chord? Why do you think that was?
I think it's all about democratizing resources and assets. I think that is the underlying theme of crypto. When I first learned, it's actually funny. My girlfriend taught me like everything about cryptocurrency. And you know, I think when I was first sold on it, she told me about USDC and DAI and how these two stable currencies were democratizing access to stable money, which is crazy because we are, I don't exactly know where you're based, but I'm in the US, and you know, we have access to a pretty good banking system and a pretty stable financial infrastructure. And we just take for granted that we have a stable currency. And so one of the early themes of crypto was, how can we democratize access to the US dollar? And they did that with these stable coins called DAI and USDC, where they literally kept like a dollar in the bank for every dollar they would issue to prop up a stable currency. And I think CityDAO has a very similar theme to this, which is, you know, something like land. Like land is, think about land. You associate it with, you know, aristocrats owning this land, apartments. You associate with these big real estate investment trusts. And you know, I think the idea of, wow, an individual person can have a stake in their land or their city or own a piece of this, you know, this parcel of land is a really magnetic idea. Because it just you know, it's democratizing access to something that only maybe the upper echelon of society used to be able to have a slice of that pie.
Right. So I think people are sort of getting the flavor of what CityDAO is from sort of touching on it from a few different angles. But if you go and have to explain it like in the simplest terms possible to like, for example, my grandma, how are you explaining, you know, like what CityDAO is, why it's important, and you know, she doesn't understand what like a DAO is or, you know, how like what a protocol is and all of these things. How do you like approach the most fundamental explanation of what this is that you're building?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think it's funny because we kind of live in this internet bubble where you take for granted that you know, oh, everyone understands like all these you know, things you're talking about. And then I go back and talk to my parents and they're, you know, it's the type of thing that's like, you know, quite hard to describe. You know, and the way I describe it is it's not that different from, you know, the w when you go buy land now, you basically put a document on file with the county recorder and you know, people have to approve that document. No, what if this process was instant, just happened basically just on the internet through a ledger? And you know, there were less gatekeepers to determining, you know, can you get a loan for this property? Are you eligible? You have to sign here. Basically, fewer gatekeepers, transparent, open ledger, I think are some of the like why. But I think that's kind of the theme is like I try to describe the like why is this important versus like what are you don't need to understand like you don't need to understand like how, you know, proof of stake algorithms work to understand why, you know, Ethereum and Bitcoin are cool, for example. You don't need to understand like the nitty-gritty of like zoning and land use to understand like, you know, it makes more sense to be able to buy a piece of land in one click over the internet than it does to have to go through you know, jump through hoops and fill out forms and you know, talk to your county department of land or whatever to get a piece of land.
Sure. So I think we've sort of addressed, you know, why should this exist? It sort of democratizes access to land, potentially makes it one click instead of this big complex process. So no longer do you need like this specific knowledge or a large amount of money in order to buy land. Theoretically, anyone could buy land and you don't have to buy a huge property. You can just buy a small fraction of this property that's owned by the DAO, the decentralized autonomous organization, which sort of accumulates it and then sells it to its citizens. And we'll get into how you guys are building this community of citizens. You mentioned the Discord group with a couple thousand people involved, but you've also got a bit more of a sort of formal, I don't know if ownership, I guess ownership is a reasonable way to say it, but you know, everyone and their mothers have heard about NFTs over the last year with just them hitting the mainstream, and you guys are using NFTs to sort of grant citizenship, which I think is definitely really cool. But before we go in that direction, I want to talk about not why this should exist, but why this should exist now. And I think a large driver, it's not why should it exist now. You could argue that, you know, it should have existed for a while, but there was a catalyst that sort of enabled it to exist now, I think, from your perspective, which is the Wyoming DAO law. So if you could explain a bit about what that is and why that is sort of the catalyst here, or if there's other catalysts that I'm not aware of, would be great to hear about like why this is possible now, where it literally wouldn't have been, or at least wouldn't have been quite as feasible even just a year ago.
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, the answer is Wyoming is trying to be the most, you know, crypto innovation friendly state. And I think it's working. And so, you know, for context, Wyoming was the first state to legalize or to create the LLC, the limited liability company that is now a mainstream, you know, staple of business. And other states basically copied it, started adopting it. And now they are the first state to introduce these DAO LLCs, which, you know, if this goes well, I'm sure other states will start copying that. You know, and the real magic behind the DAO LLC is that, you know, a DAO can govern this LLC And the LLC can own assets in the physical world. So kind of by this transitive property, the DAO can own assets in the physical world. So I think that's the real breakthrough. But, you know, I read the full text of the law, and I recommend, if you're interested in a huge nerd like, you know, we are, then you your listeners should go read it, because it's pretty accessible. And, you know, it has one provision that basically says, you know, we will recognize the code in your smart contract as the governance mechanism for your LLC. And to kind of translate that, is what it basically means is that, you know, let's say our smart contract says that, you know, Scott owns this parcel of land, Jake owns this parcel of land. That means that when, you know, push comes to shove, and let's say there's some land disputes or conflicts, a court of law will theoretically, this has never happened yet, but they will theoretically, you know, open a smart contract, look at the code and say, oh yeah, Jake owns this parcel, you know, oh, Jake owes Scott this money, and basically be able to see, you know, things in the smart contract and recognize the legality of those claims. And contrast that to the current system where, you know, I could just say, hey, this parcel in New York is now tokenized. I hereby declare it tokenized. And I hereby give you 10 tokens. A court could see this at some point and be like, well, no, you can't actually tokenize this land. We do not recognize this claim. It is not valid. So the real magic of this Wyoming DAO law is recognizing the legal claims in these smart contracts, which I think will kind of be the breakthrough innovation here for, you know, allowing these claims and these like legal status of things to exist on chain.
Yeah. So what's super cool about that at face value is it turns a bunch of paper and sort of outdated legalese into code. The sort of devil's advocate in me wonders, and I'm curious if you have any sort of response to this, like how you said it, I think, you know, that it's yet to really present itself in practice. But I'm not even sure how like a court would go and figure out like the code. Is that something that you've thought about, like the practical application of you know, it's one thing to say that you'll observe the smart contracts as law in a sense, or as, you know, legal, like sort of binding action or whatever it might be. But there's another thing to like, how do they actually go and implement that? Do you have any ideas as how that might unfold?
Yeah, I think this is interesting. And I think, you know, it brings up the, you know, the exciting opportunity here, which is we are going to be trailblazers and we are going to find out what happens. And we are literally going to push the bleeding edge of, you know, what is legally possible, and kind of create a new mechanism for land ownership. So I think that is why CityDAO is so cool, because we're going to find out what happens. And, you know, I think, you know, it sounds crazy that a court would just like open an ether scan and pull up a contract. But, you know, I think that, you know, we could basically just present, you know, here is the smart contract, here's what it says. And, you know, I think that, you know, citizens on a jury or judges, you know, they're smart people who can understand these claims. So I think they would actually do it. And I think we'll probably find out in the next, you know, year or so, how that mechanism exactly works.
Yeah, it's interesting. We might need to get some like crypto people into the judges' seats somehow. I don't know how long that'll take, but it could be helpful for all of this, I imagine. Maybe Wyoming will have like the most progressive set of judges in the country or something like that. But it's definitely interesting how Wyoming is enabling organizations like CityDAO to explore this sort of frontier and the cutting edge. One thing that's been intriguing to me for a while, from like the first time I learned about seasteading to learning more about like charter cities and the like, is this concept that different jurisdictions may be able to experiment with different sets of law. And you can sort of think of these things as like different sets of code. And you then, you know, see what works where. And of course, there's difference in climate and population and demographic and all of these things. Like some country might have great like oil business and another has great farming or whatever it might be, energy. But there's some sort of like policies, whether they're financial or something like this, that would seem to carry over. And so the concept of what's called, I think, experimental governance, or at least that's how I think about it, becomes really interesting, where you have these smaller jurisdictions around the world, whether it's, you know, a small part of Honduras or a small part of a European country or even a small part of Wyoming that gets to sort of operate with their own set of laws a little bit. Do you think that City DAO, if it's able to accumulate enough land and sort of leverage with the local government, could have the opportunity to do some of this experimental stuff and serve as somewhat of a model for other regions of the world, or, you know, starting with maybe Wyoming, you know, outside of the City DAO land in Wyoming, and it becomes state law and then maybe federal? Do you think it can sort of play around with different forms of governance and potentially serve as a model for other jurisdictions around the world?
I think so. And I think what you're alluding to is a very exciting future for, you know, I think City DAO is really just the beginning. And I think you'll find a lot of people in the City DAO community are excited about something more along the lines of Country DAO, where it's, you know, how do you completely operate a decentralized organization? And, you know, how do you encode laws on chain? How do you encode, you know, a justice system, a legislative branch? How could you basically, you know, put all these mechanisms on chain and basically, you know, increase transparency and kind of, you know, use some mechanism design for, you know, the public good in a way? You know, maybe this ways you can think about that are like, you know, allocating tax dollars via voting. And there's a lot of mechanisms that Vitalik discusses. And there's a great website about the organization doing work on this called Radical Exchange. And basically, a lot of the ideas come from a book called Radical Markets by Glenn Wild. And they kind of talk about, you know, things like quadratic voting, quadratic funding, mechanisms to allow people to vote and govern decentralized communities, and, you know, ideally, like, make our democracy stronger by giving people more input and more skin in the game. So I think there's, you know, so much potential to kind of rethink, kind of how you know, certain things are governed and zoned and things like that. I think I'm personally also an urbanist, and I'm, you know, kind of been watching the California housing crisis, you know, and I see this as a result of kind of poor policy, faulty mechanism design. And so, you know, I think something like City DAO or its successor Country DAO can basically, you know, hopefully avoid a lot of the pitfalls that kind of are created by having like entrenched interests and, you know, by basically using mechanism design and blockchain to create more transparent, legible systems.
Right. So what are like the low hanging fruit from your perspective in terms of these different mechanisms that you might be able to incorporate? You know, there's like the long-term vision of maybe there's something like a Country DAO, and I don't know if that's sort of grows out of City DAO or is something that sort of, you know, grows separately alongside it after City DAO maybe does like a proof of concept or something like this. But for City DAO itself, like very near term, you've got this really excited community and some dollars now to put behind it. What are like the first most interesting and sort of most easy to incorporate experiments that you guys are thinking about running?
Yeah, this is a great question. So the first one is just going to be around different ways to govern and allocate land. So one way we've been thinking about it is how do you allocate land in an envy-free way? And, you know, in the book I was mentioning, Radical Markets, they talk about how allowing someone complete ownership of land or ownership of anything is basically granting a monopoly. And, you know, usually in competitive markets, we want to minimize monopolies. And so to tie it back to the City DAO experiment, one thing we're looking at is, you know, maybe we make 33% of parcels for sale right now. And the owner just gets to keep them. Maybe we make 33% of them available to lease yearly so that they can kind of come to a more fair market price for leasing and no one gets a monopoly over those. And then maybe we have 33% subject to what's called the harbinger tax. And so I highly recommend listeners go read about the harbinger tax, which is a mechanism to basically, it's kind of, you know, a mechanism to allow some sort of common ownership of things. So basically, you buy something, you have to pay a tax to own that thing. So it could be a low tax. For example, you buy a piece of land, you have to pay a 1% tax. And you basically self-assess the price of that thing. So you say, this land is worth, you know, $1 million to me, and I will pay that $10,000 tax to prove it's worth that much to me. But if someone values the land more than you, they can come and buy the land for $1 million because you basically get to set the price of that. And so this basically allows for more efficient allocation of resources, whereas right now you could, you know, go buy pieces of land and go speculate on them. I know people have kind of maybe seen BlackRock is like buying up single family homes, for example, and you know, basically just like you know, when you own something, you have a monopoly over it. And there's a lot of opportunity to innovate around what does ownership mean? How do you allocate things more fairly?
Yeah, so I actually have a follow-up on the Harbinger taxes, because I spoke about this briefly with Vitalik and it was like 70 plus episodes ago, so I'm a little rusty on it. But as I recall, I think one of the things that you just said that changed my understanding of it, and I need to go back and sort of read the details, I guess. But I had asked him something along the lines of like, what if you're just like a run-of-the-mill family that like wants to buy your house, but or you know, wants to maintain ownership of your house, but and so you have to sort of like pay on a higher valuation than you actually think it's worth, or than like anyone else would possibly think it's worth, because you just like have that sort of sentimental value and like really want to keep it. But what you just said was like, you know, maybe it's just a 1% tax on purchase or something like this, which to me tells like two things. So like one, there's a potential that like the Harbinger tax could be just a one-time tax at purchase rather than like an annual tax that most people are familiar with. And second, that it's less like what we commonly regard as taxes, which are like a fair, you know, a reasonably high percentage of the overall value, to something like where it's just 1%, where actually, you know, it might make sense to if you really want to hang on to your thing, you just pay, you know, 1% on, you know, 3x what anyone else would reasonably willing to pay for it, because you really want to keep it. Am I sort of misunderstanding how that mechanism works, or could you sort of elaborate on how you see that sort of playing out?
Yes, so the tax should be every year, but the way you described it is basically correct, where a lower tax confers more privilege and rights to the owner. So, for example, a 1% tax is very low, which means that the owner can set a very high price to buy to force buy that property. So, for example, like the situation of the, you know, you want to stay in your family home, that's very reasonable. So I think that you exactly described this correctly, where you know, for things that like a home, right, it seems very unjust for someone to just get kicked out of their home just because, you know, a higher bidder comes along, which is why I think a lower tax is great, because it means that you can self-assess a much higher price than most people would be willing to pay. That said, for things that you want to have more turnover, so for example, let's say we actually wanted these land parcels to be aggressively allocated to the person putting them to the most efficient use, then we would increase the tax to 10 or 20%, and that way it would encourage people to keep a lower, you know, price at which they have to pay taxes on, which would lead to more kind of turnover and acquisition.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if there's like a sentimental value like variable attached to figuring out what the percentage is, and also it's sort of like a an ease of transition, like, you know, moving your family home. It's one thing on the sentimental side, but it's also just like a huge pain to like be moving every year or two or whatever. So you want to like have reasonable certainty you can keep it. But there's other things that, you know, especially like these digital goods, and including land, if it's just transferable with the press of a button, that you know, there's not really any concern. I think digital goods both tend to be, you know, this isn't like a always true probably, but they tend to be have less sentimental value than something physical, such as like a home, especially. And also they're just like super easily transferable. So maybe you have, to your point, a much higher tax percentage on that to sort of enable it to be more fairly priced, or just lower priced, closer to the fair market value, so that it turns over more. So that's interesting, and it'll be interesting to see you guys explore mechanisms like that. Can you talk a bit more as well about this other mechanism you mentioned, like the quadratic voting slash quadratic funding piece, and why that's interesting to explore as a DAO?
Yeah, that's a very interesting topic, which, you know, the idea is basically that you know, our current voting system does not allow you to express the degree of preference, right? The current voting system is yes, no. It's very binary. So the idea behind you know, a lot of these quadratic voting or funding mechanisms is that you know, people should be able to allocate credits in a more fluid way, So one example of this is, the example in the book Radical Markets is along the lines of, you know, there is a small vocal minority of people in Japan who want hunting licenses. Like they want to be able to carry a hunting rifle, but all guns and weapons are hypothetically illegal in Japan. And, you know, to earn this privilege, most people would vote no because the average person is a weak no, they don't really want weapons around. But this, you know, vocal minority of hunters really wants to be able to have a hunting rifle. And so in the story, the hunters save up their voting credits. So they basically accumulate, you know, like, let's say 100 vote credits per year, they save them up for a few years, then they get an initiative on the ballot to legalize hunting rifles. And, you know, most people vote no. 60% of the population votes weak no. But the vocal minority of, you know, hunters, they all vote yes very strongly. And the idea between with quadratic voting is, let's say, you know, you place 100 votes, you actually get to vote 10 times. Or, you know, you allocate 64 of your voting credits, you actually get, you know, eight actual votes. So the idea is that, yes, you can vote multiple times and express your preference on issues. But, you know, you have to do that. So you basically only get to allocate like your vote credits quadratically. So you don't get to just like allocate all your votes, but you get to allocate, you know, a quadratic reduced number of your votes towards a specific thing.
So is it correct to say that basically you have the opportunity to save your like total vote amount or voting power and allocate it towards like the things you care most about and sort of to I guess avoid people abusing that system? Perhaps the votes also to some extent become more expensive as you flex like a greater amount of votes as an individual. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Or you could also say the votes become less powerful as you allocate more towards the same thing.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And it's interesting, like for a situation like that, and you know, I'm sure this is somewhat top of mind that as you guys are thinking about how to work governance with the DAO. But theoretically, you know, it might be easy to vote on a few things here and there. We could talk about, I saw the first couple of votes for you guys have gone up. I believe one was on sort of approving the budget and another was on how big of plots of land you want to sell. And basically that will determine how many people you can allow to own land right off the bat, because there's only so much land you can buy initially with the funding that you have. So, you know, those are sort of two pretty simple and easy to understand things. And theoretically, everyone in the community would have some sort of preference on that. But even, you know, you could even imagine there that like someone might not really care about the budget. They're like, okay, whatever. Trust you guys, trust everyone else who's voting or whatever. But then they're like, well, I actually do have a preference on whether it's, 50 plots of land at an acre or 5,000 plots of land at 0.01 acres per plot. And so I'll vote there. And if you think about this, like, you know, you 10X or 100X or 1000X the number of proposals that are sort of out for vote at a given time, it becomes pretty burdensome for like the average person to, you know, who has all this other stuff going on, and people like you who are running a totally separate company to go and sort of evaluate 1,000 different things to vote on or 100 sure. different things to vote on. How do you think about, and I know this isn't like a thing that's unique to CityDAO by any means, this is a problem that I think a lot of people have thought about on like how to improve democracy, but how do you, like, how do you attack that problem? How do you think about that problem of allowing people to, getting the right people who care about the right issues to vote on them, and they're educated on those issues and proxy power of vote and things like this?
Yeah, there are a lot of, you know, factors to consider with this. There is, you know, no, you know, magic great answer. So right now for CityDAO, we issue, we basically have citizen NFTs that people can buy. And basically that allows you to become a citizen of CityDAO and support the project. And the reason we chose to do that over a token was, you know, a token is the definition of just like being able to buy governance, right? You can just go, you know, buy a token and have more governance rights over that protocol. And we didn't want to, have that type of system because that just feels wrong. So we've currently are doing, you know, a one person, one vote type system where you buy a citizen NFT and you have the right to vote. That said, there are, you know, a lot of things to consider with like how often you are asking the community to govern everything and make decisions. And I think, you know, one way to circumvent this is basically to use a lot of these great voting mechanisms we talked about, like, you know, quadratic voting, but to also only, you know, put like very large decisions up to the community and allow basically elected representatives to make other decisions. So, for example, you know, you could elect a representative who has general power of like allocating, you know, certain funds and making, you know, a lot of decisions. And that way, you don't have to keep asking the community to micromanage and, you know, place that big burden.
Yeah, that makes sense. And just to sort of rewind and talk about the NFT decision over token holders, it sounds like you didn't want to do it in tokens because basically every dollar you spend is additional incremental power, whereas you can only buy like one NFT at a time. I mean, I could think of like a small workaround where someone could like go do the it's a lot of extra work, I would imagine, but like you create, you know, separate wallets and start buying these NFTs to those different wallets, and it's the same person in control of each of them to sort of accumulate voting power that way. But aside from that sort of edge case, is that the only reason why you guys want NFTs over tokens, or was there sort of broader consideration there as to which one to go forward with? Because obviously, you know, NFTs themselves, everything you guys are doing is super cutting edge. You know, the Wyoming law comes out, and you know, within a month or two, I think you guys are launched. But NFTs themselves are, you know, a degree of magnitude more cutting edge, I would say, than tokens, which it's basically like a 10-year versus a 1-year in existence type of thing, if you sort of round a little bit. So how did you think about that decision, or was it just the voting power that sort of determined it?
Yeah, I think it was also based around like the type of culture we wanted to have. And I think you know, if a project just launches a token as the first thing they do, I think that's kind of a bad look, because it just, you know, you basically are doing some sort of ICO and you're giving away your token. Your token is kind of your equity in a way. And you know, also I think depending on your token offering, it can be like a securities offering and all that stuff. You know, I think the idea with NFTs is it was really just people donating to the project, and you know, you're getting some sort of, you know, like community and governance rights and things like that too. But you know, a lot of it was just people wanting to support the project, and help us fund our first parcel of land. And you know, to address your point about just creating different wallets, we use proof of humanity. So basically, you know, there's a protocol called proof of humanity, which basically helps you verify that people are real humans. And you know, you can link to like Twitter accounts and do different things. So this is how other protocols like Gitcoin avoid people, you know, like allocating funding in malicious ways by just creating tons of fake accounts. Or Mirror, the writing service, also does something like this, where you kind of verify your Twitter. So yeah, we'll be using that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wasn't aware of that, but proof of humanity is something that I think not a lot of people might have expected we would have to have maybe 20 years ago, but very much relevant now. When you talk about these NFTs, I saw on OpenSea, as well as some of your guys' essays, you had, I believe, a First Citizen NFT that went for somewhere north of like 20 grand, a certain number of ETH. All of this is sort of denominated in ETH because it's built on ETH. And then you had, I think, 15, I forget what the terminology was. I think 15 first citizens and 50 founding citizens. And the price tags on, I think I was looking at the 50 founding citizens are, it's pretty high. I think it's like maybe 10 grand or something like this. How do you think about, like, were these initial sales surprising to you on the low end, on the high end? How do you think about the value that people are sort of paying for right now before you guys have bought the land? And how does that then translate to like next steps, actually buying the land and giving people various parcels? I don't think these people are like automatically granted parcels. I think the parcels just go for sale and these people have priority, but would love to hear like your impression of sort of the early days. These sort of pre-sale NFTs that have happened on building your initial citizens, and how you see all of that playing out.
Yeah, the NFT sales definitely exceeded expectations, and you know, gave us the resources we need to buy that first parcel of land. You know, and I think that the Yeah, the NFTs really just give you the right to know about the parcel of land and, buy a parcel before everyone else gets access to it. So basically, the guy who bought the first citizen NFT, his name's Justin, he'll get the first pick of, does he want to buy a parcel of land? And then the founding citizens, which there were 50 of those, they will get the next pick of what parcels of land they want to buy. And then after that, the other, the regular citizens will get to buy land. And if there's any land left over, we'll open it to the public. So it's basically just kind of the order of operations there. And, kind of like I said, it was really, people just excited to support the project. I think there was definitely some, FOMO and excitement around getting your hands on these NFTs. The NFT is basically a glowing copy of the CityDAO Articles of Incorporation overlaid over a map of Wyoming. So it's kind of a cool kind of commemorative design, and I think a lot of people are proud of saying like I was part of this project. I was a founding citizen of this project. I think that's a pretty cool statement to make.
Yeah, it's super cool, and I think I'm gonna have to go and buy a citizen NFT after this. I missed the founding citizen vote, but that's okay. I'd love to have an early look at the land. When do you guys think that you'll go ahead and purchase some land and sell it out in parcels to the community, starting with these citizens, and maybe eventually the public if there's any left? And have you guys sort of begun the process of looking at, where you actually might want to acquire that land? And I'd be curious, I've always been intrigued by Wyoming. I think it's a beautiful state, and the crypto progressive laws certainly don't hurt. And I'm sort of bullish on the state overall. But I'm curious if there's anywhere in particular that you guys have been looking, or any sort of thesis on where you might like to buy the land and what type of land and why.
Yeah, we are narrowing in on a parcel right now. We have a couple brokers who have been kind of sending us different parcels within our price range. And so at first we were looking in the Jackson Hole area, which is near Yellowstone, but I think that area is really expensive, and we would end up getting a very small parcel that would be very hard to subdivide. So now we're looking near the town of Cody, Wyoming, which has the Yellowstone Regional Airport that has quite frequent flights very close to Yellowstone. Is fun fact is it's actually the town where Kanye West kind of has like a residence, and he's kind of like known for being seen around the town. So we're looking at buying a property probably around 40 minutes north of Cody, in Clark County. So there's a lot of properties around here that are great for building. So we are optimizing for something a little more flat and large to enable people to use it how they want. I think a flat property is kind of like a clean slate, a blank slate of if you want to try to build something on your little parcel. If you want to go visit it and use it for recreational uses, you can do that. So yeah, that's kind of how we're thinking about that initial parcel of land. And so we should have an announcement coming soon on that once we select that additional parcel. But it looks like it's going to be in the like depending on location, it'll be in the like 20 to 50 acre range. And yeah, one of the governance proposals that citizens can vote on is, how exactly should we divide that parcel? Should we make a lot of small parcels available to a lot of people, or should we have fewer larger parcels so that fewer people could have kind of their own ranch style larger property? So that'll be something that the community can help decide.
Okay, yeah, and that's super exciting. So I want to sort of paint a picture of the next year or two or few, to the extent that you can, understanding this is so cutting edge, it may be hard to see even a few months ahead. But so say you buy this land, you get the resolution on the vote, and end up selling, just for ease of example, let's say 50 acres to 50 people. I think it'd be cool. My personal vote, and maybe I'll make it when I get a citizen NFT, but my personal vote would probably be to give smaller plots to a few more people. But let's say 50 and 50 for ease of example. And let's say I'm a citizen and I go ahead and I buy one of these plots that you're offering. What happens like from there? Can I start to do things with this land? If I then, say I build, like maybe I get like a modular home on top of the land, and then I want to sell the land with the home on it. What are some sort of next step scenarios that you can envision from when you get the land and sell it and thereafter?
Yeah, so we are going to publish like a list of allowed things that you can do on the land. So it's actually funny because even in Wyoming, there are zoning laws that kind of limit what exactly you can do. So for example, there may be a limit to the number of modular homes you can have. There might be restrictions on what types of animals you could in theoretically hunt on this parcel, or what types of things you can build. So there are simple things like you can't build certain types of oil refineries. But it is Wyoming, where a lot of things are legal, which is really great, which makes this a really great place to test out the experiment. So yeah, once we kind of get that first initial parcel up and running, I think I do predict that some of the value will just be kind of the novelty of like I own the first piece of land that's ever been put on chain and the novelty around that. But that said, I really hope that people do actually visit the land. And something we're going to do is I'm actually going to visit Wyoming in October, and I'm going to plant a CityDAO flag. So someone is kind of designing and making a flag of CityDAO that we're going to put on the land for fun and take a picture of to just kind of symbolize, celebrate that we own this land now. And kind of more towards the future vision of that's kind of this first parcel, but there's so many interesting experiments we can get to continue running, and really I hope it's very community led of like what people want to do. But some ideas are things like basically having a conservation parcel where we buy a parcel in a kind of endangered area where it's like a forest and an ecosystem that might be fragile, and basically people can buy parcels of that forest, and basically they don't have the right to actually develop anything. It's just purely to protect and donate to preserving the natural landscape, which I think that'd be a really, really cool idea. There's also some ideas more around real estate, where it's like you could buy something, and then the community co collectively governs the same parcel. So for example, like community collectively buys a piece of land in Jackson, Wyoming, and agrees to build a apartment or something, and kind of come together and decide what exactly they want to build on that property. So yeah, so lots of potential, so many cool directions to really go with the project. Yeah.
Yeah, it's all very cool, and I can't imagine. I mean, I can start to imagine, but I can't imagine all the things that may sort of grow out of this or something like this. It's a super interesting project, and certainly admire the fact that you guys just got going on it like the minute it was possible with the Wyoming law. So we'll continue to look out for updates and be rooting for you guys and for the project as it moves forward. Thanks so much, Scott, for joining today. I think we'll wrap up here. We're coming up on time, but where can people go and follow you and CityDAO? And I wish we could have spent a little bit of time on Air Garage, which is also like seems like a great idea and an interesting company. But CityDAO is just like endlessly fascinating to me. So not super surprised that we got stuck in the rabbit hole there. Where can people go and sort of keep updated on all this stuff and follow you along your journey?
Yeah, definitely. To see what we're up to with CityDAO, you can go to citydao.io, and you can see when we launch our first parcel. You can get citizenship if you're interested in that, and kind of you can join our Discord community. So citydao.io for that. And then if you want to follow me, I actually just released a new website that's still putting some finishing touches, but it's scott.xyz. So you can go follow me there, and I publish some blog posts and talk about cities and crypto and some various things on there.
Very cool. Scott.xyz is a nice piece of digital real estate that you got yourself
Yeah,
there. So congratulations on that. And we'll look forward to seeing what's next for you and for CityDAO and Air Garage and all the rest.
awesome. Thanks for having me, Jake.